Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The arts are an integral to the fabric of the Cape and Islands. Not only does this place inspire creativity and attract artists of all mediums, but the arts also help drive our economy. Later in the hour, we discuss Making Waves, a creative arts festival focused on climate justice, social equity, and community storytelling, hosted by Cape Cod Community College. But first, ArtWorks. It's a program run by the Cape and Islands Workforce Board to grow the creative economy while offering students opportunities to grow as artists and entrepreneurs. Joining us to talk about the program, Samantha Fonseca, Youth Services Director at the Mass Higher Cape and Islands Workforce Board. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Andy Troyonis is ArtWorks Mentor. Hi, Andy.
Hello.
And Betsy Payne Cook, also ArtWorks Mentor. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
Samantha, how is the ArtWorks program set up and what's the mission?
Great question. So ArtWorks is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And the mission has been about to inspire, prepare the young adults of the region for the arts industry and the creative economy, and strengthen that arts industry. The program originally started with offering the mentorship to students in grades juniors and senior year. Now we offer this program to students grades 9 through 12. So they have the opportunity to participate in this mentorship with a local artist in an artistic medium of their choice. So they're really fostering those mentorship relationships between emerging and established artists across Cape Cod, and just ensuring that we are a part of the arts, remaining that vibrant part of Cape Cod identity and the workforce.
Other than expanding the grades, how has the, you mean three decades, right? How has it evolved and grown over time?
Absolutely. So not only just with student engagement, each year we grow the program, and also the art disciplines. So we never turn down a student that applies to the ArtWorks program. They bring the selected medium of their choice to us, and then we do the work to find a mentor in that medium. So we've certainly seen the students' interests change over the years. The program began with the kind of the foundations of art as painting and drawing, and now we're seeing more ceramics, we have stained glass, glass blowing, music, culinary arts, even architecture, landscaping. I mean, they truly, anything in that creative arts industry, they bring it to us and we find the mentor for them. And also too, we offer the program now in a consistent three models. So students don't have to participate solely in person. It can be a hybrid meeting. It can be solely virtual. We actually have an artist that is lives in New Hampshire. She's from Cape Cod, but they're able to do virtually over drawing over Zoom. So we've tried to get creative with the time, stay innovative, and be able to make sure that we're reaching all students in terms of what we can offer.
Andy, before we talk about your role as a mentor, tell us a little bit about your art.
Hi, I'm a longtime music teacher, 35-year music teacher and performer in the area, guitarist, and I know other instruments as well. When I got into this program, I was not sure exactly how to do it exactly, because I've taught private lessons for guitar for 35 years. But what I noticed is the kids came in with some knowledge, and they were looking at a different angle to get into the music, to understand something. And that's kind of my job as a mentor, is to give them another angle to look at, another way to solve a problem, another way to look at a solution for something they're working on. They'll bring me a song, and then we'll say, well, why don't we try it from this way? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the key to anything with young people in art, that you want to have them work on something and find a bunch of ways to solve problems, because if they can do that, they really can do anything in life. Mm-hmm. And that's what the ArtWorks program really, with one-on-one mentoring, you really can change a student, change a life.
Yeah, for sure. And how did you hear about the ArtWorks program?
Samantha, you had a connection with Mashpee High School, if I remember right.
Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah. We heard, and then they knew my wife, Deborah, who is an art teacher also from Mashpee High School and recently retired, and we made the connection that way.
Oh, so, Samantha, you're reaching out to the schools.
Yes, we partner with all the high schools on the Cape and Islands.
Yeah. Betsy, tell us about your art and what prompted you to become a mentor at ArtWorks.
Well, thank you. I'm primarily a pastel painter, and I paint both in the studio, but I also thoroughly enjoy the painting outdoors. And plein air painting on the Cape is really an ideal way to just get out there and, see the colors that are in the landscape, the lighting, and actually to even meet people. And I think the biggest thing I would say about art in general and speaking with the students is, although I'm a pastel painter, I really like to explore mediums that work with pastel. And that's what I'd like to bring to the table with the students that I work with is exploring, gaining confidence in what you do. And that's been a big part of working with the variety of students over the past. I've been doing it for, I think it's 7 years. Is really, targeting that inner part of what they feel about being creative and what is it you can do with it and how you can explore materials.
Yeah, you just brought up a really good point in that instilling the confidence, right? Which is so
Correct.
important, especially that students in that teenage year where they sort of second guess themselves, right? Smitha, how do you
Exactly.
find mentors, and what kinds of mediums are represented by ArtsWorks mentors?
Great question. Truly, we're recruiting our mentors through word of mouth. Social media is a big part of our ArtWorks program. And then also through the connection of the wonderful artists that are in our program. Typically, if a student brings a medium to us that we don't already have a mentor for example, violin, Andy was a great help in securing a violinist for us. So we really utilize that network of our artists pool we have currently. But then also, we work closely with the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod and some other partner organizations of ours in terms of recruiting mentors for our upcoming year.
Betsy, you mentioned 7 years. Do you know how many students you've mentored at this part point? And are there any like moments that of those relationships that stand out?
Yes, the over the 7 years, I've been a one-on-one mentor. So it's been a wonderful way to really get to know students. And of course, in any relationship, even with the mentor mentee, complexity of them coming and spending a short amount of time with you each week is there's certain students that I think had such a high interest that art was actually part of who they were. And so that creative sense, I think that connection with them really made a huge difference in the amount of work that we did together. And in thinking of the different students that I have, typically it's the ones that really have, like really thoroughly engaged. And I've had a wide variety of students from, students that, kind of like art and they maybe took art classes and let's give it a try. Great. That's wonderful. I love that sort of person because they're just willing to jump in and try things. And other ones that have a real mission and they've got ideas and they just want to run with it and they just need someone to give them either tools or techniques, encouragement that, yeah, you're going in the right direction. And a lot of it is that creative part of not really needing to have a vision before you start, but to at least just start.
Yeah.
And I've even had students that maybe needed a lot of support to just get
Just get
started. And
started,
I
yes.
think a lot of that comes from the fact that they put too much in importance into what the finished product looks like. So it's instilling in them that it's the process of creating. It's not necessarily how it turns out. It's like, what did you do while you were? And I love what Andy said about, problem solving, because that is a big part of life. And, when you can problem solve, that makes such a huge difference. And again, it goes with that confidence, building
Yeah.
confidence.
And these students are also with you to learn more about the business side of art, right? So could talk about some of the skills and entrepreneurial knowledge that you pass along.
About professional music, I just let, as a musician, let them know that they have to work really, really hard if they expect to make a living from doing music. I know that's the 10,000 hour mastery rule, and I just kind of let them know, if you're not practicing, then you probably want to look at something else, and maybe music will be a hobby for you, because it's so difficult, and it's different. It's the same with all mediums if you're not invested. But we do get a wide variety of students who are really dedicated. I know Liam, one of the first students I had, has gone to Bridgewater for music, but other students I have seem to have just really strong interest and just want to be part of music, part of something else. I know I had an electronic student who was working off of his computer and really couldn't play anything, but he was working off making his own sound beats, which is was new to me. And we had to kind of g took a little longer to make a connection on that. But when we did, we talked about form and some aspects of music. And there's we did talk about that's a way of making money too. It's just they know they have to work hard if they want to be successful at something. And that, I don't know, with this generation, that can be tricky to make that connection with sometimes, but it's definitely a point I try and get home to them.
I think my grandson's band teacher says you have to practice every day that ends in Y.
There you go.
Yes,
All right. So, Samantha, how do you match the mentors and mentees?
great question. So, there is an application process both for the mentor and the student. And then with that, we like to not only connect with our mentors, but each student's also interviewed. So through that interview process, we're learning not only about, what artistic ability they have, but then also their goals for their program, their schedule, of course, the busy high schoolers. And then it's kind of like one big puzzle. We look at our mentor pool, we look at our students, and of course, starting with the mediums and then working our way down to scheduling. But that interview piece is definitely key.
Yeah. Betsy, making a living as an artist can be challenging. How do you help your mentees set realistic expectations while also encouraging them to grow creatively?
That's an excellent question in terms of making a living at being an artist. And I think it's really important for students to know on the onset, especially if they are, I've had two students that have gone on to college and have received degrees in art. It's a fickle industry, and it is one that you do have to work hard at. There are very many artists, as I tell students, that actually have jobs that actually pay the bills. And that, it's not a deterrent. It's the reality of being creative. And with creativity comes an immense and very wide range of what people like. So just because only a small section of people may like the type of art that you do, it doesn't mean you're gonna be able to survive on selling that art. And I think the other thing too is, I really feel as if so often the economic part of it overrides students continuing on with something that they love. And it's a reality of life. You have to pay bills. So it's instilling in them that realization that you can still do it. You might need support. You might need to have another job or career. I mean, I was in education. So the bulk of my artistic life was towards the end of my retirement and afterwards. But it doesn't mean I didn't do it. And I think that's the difference, is you are going to do it one way or another if it's something that's part of who you are. You just have to decide, are you going to be the one that, really can, hit that 1% at the top that can make a living selling your paintings? Or are you going to be happy, in another career and supplement it? Doesn't mean you're not an artist. And I think that's a big word. People think artists have to be someone who's slaving away for their, and yes, they are. They are slaving away. But the reality of it is you can be an artist and you can be other things too. And I think it's important for students to know that.
Samantha, beyond artistic skills, what
Absolutely.
personal or professional growth do students take away from this program?
Great question. So, not only are those just the art skills that they acquire within the mentorship, but it's also those transferable life skills. So beyond the arts, the students are truly building communication, teamwork, leadership. We kind of talk about this lifelong confidence that this mentorship truly builds for the mentees in this program.
How many students have participated in Artworks over the past 3 decades, and what kinds of opportunities has the program opened up for them?
Great question. So there has been thousands of students that we have been able to reach with the Artworks program. The opportunities are kind of endless to the student that is applying. We talked a lot about the business side of the arts that the students are learning from their mentor. It's that professional mentorship, as we call it, that they're being open to and exposed to. They're getting that hands-on learning. So we talk a lot about work-based learning skills in our traditional internship program here, those career readiness skills, and of course, employability skills. So those skills that they can really adapt to any form of employment that they choose, even if arts is just one of them. And then, of course, that showcase and recognition skills that they receive also, as well as each year the Artworks program culminates with an end of the year exhibit.
And are you always looking for mentors?
Always, absolutely always. The mentor application always stays live on our website. So please check it out.
All right, so Andy and Betsy, tell us why somebody should consider becoming a mentor with Artworks. Betsy, we'll start with you and then we'll hear from Andy.
Working with the younger generation is that's why I was in education. I loved working with the younger generation and working in this close relationship that you can build with our younger generation that is coming up and is going to be in charge of the world. I mean, it's just really such a benefit to me to know what they're thinking, what is it that they want to do with their lives, what is it they want to do with their art, their art self, their creativity. So I think it's that personal connection, and that's where Artworks, I think, really does stand out, is because you do have that opportunity. And of course, that there's a range of students, as I mentioned before. And I've had two students that really have just, I felt as if they blossomed through the arts program. And it's not just what they're getting, but it's also what I'm getting. So I think it's a two-way street here. And I think that's one of the biggest things that, I take away from being part of the Artworks program.
Andy, what about for you?
Yeah, as a student myself, I look back at the teachers who changed my life, and that's why I got involved with education in the first place. And then, with our Artworks, it's a one-on-one connection, and we're dealing with a generation of young people who have way too much screen time and too many other things when they're not dealing and communicating with other people. So, having a half hour or an hour with a student a week where you're looking at them and dialogue and getting in, and some of the kids are very shy, they don't communicate well. So it is a personal thing. It just it's hopefully enhancing another life, and that's the most rewarding part of it.
Samantha, Artworks is celebrating the 30th anniversary of the program today, October 9th. Is it open to the public?
That is correct. Yes, it'll be hosted at the West End in Hyannis.
We'll post more information about Artworks at our website, capeandislands.org. Samantha Fonseca, Youth Director, Services Director at the Mass Higher Cape and Islands Workforce Board, Andy Troyanos, Artworks Mentor, and Betsy Payne Cook, Artworks Mentor. Thank you all for being with us. Appreciate that.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we discuss the Making Waves Festival at Cape Cod Community College, focused on climate justice, social equity, and community storytelling. Cape Cod Community College is hosting a 3-day creative festival focused on climate justice, social equity, and community storytelling. The festival is already in its second day. It runs through tomorrow evening at the Four Seas campus in West Barnstable and in Hyannis at the Cape Cod Art Barn. And joining us to talk about the Waves of Change Art Festival, Tim Miller, Festival Co-Director and Head of the Film Festival Component. Hi, Tim. Welcome
back.
Hey,
Mindy.
Ava Fedoroff, Festival Co-Director and Head of the Visual Arts Component. Hi, Ava.
Hi.
And Marie Blackburn Youngers, Festival Community Liaison and a Community Leader in Falmouth and Across the Cape. Good to see you again, Marie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So before we jump into the festival itself, let's back up where the idea for the festival came from. Ava, how did you settle on the themes and who do you hope to engage?
Oh, that's such a great question. Well, this actually was inspired by the existence of SEGI, the Social and Economic Justice Institute at Cape Cod Community College, which is also kind of a new institute, a new project at the college. And it was inspired actually originally by a film screening that happened on campus. And our dean, Kathy McCarran, said, God, this film screening was so meaningful and so many people came out to it. Maybe we should have a film festival, a social justice film festival. And she mentioned it to me and I said, I love that idea. Maybe we should have an arts festival because, you know, as a visual artist, as, you know, a professor of visual art and an area coordinator for the visual arts, that's kind of always where my mind goes. And one of the things that's so great about, you know, all the sort of multifaceted aspect of the arts is that there's so many different ways to address social justice. And there's so many different types of social justice. As you kind of mentioned in the intro, there's climate justice, you know, ecological justice, economic justice, you know, cultural justice. There's so many different ways that we can talk about what justice is, and artists are uniquely poised to be able to do that and to bring that conversation into our space and into our community. And our school is, you know, really, you know, wanting to focus on putting community forward. So really bringing the community into the conversation. And so we see this arts festival as a way of really bringing community into the spotlight as well.
Yeah.
So that's how it came along.
Marie, activism is probably the first word that comes to mind for many people when we think about making change. But the arts can be a powerful tool for expression, engagement, and education, as Ava was just kind of mentioning. Talk more about this and how creativity and activism can go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm just so glad to be a part of this movement. I think Kathy McCarran at the college recognized in me my love for the arts. Chase, my son, and I spend the majority of our time in theaters and doing things around arts. And my other passion and love is social justice. So when you meld the two, I think we're able to use all the creativity within us to tell the stories. I think we are the griots, so to speak. We are the poets, we are the artists, we are the dancers, the musicians, and we can tell stories of justice through those mediums, you know. So I just think it's just a perfect melding of the two.
Yeah. Ava, tell us more about some of the visual art exhibits. What are the themes explored and where can people see the exhibits?
Yes. Well, we are going to be having exhibitions campus-wide. So not just in the gallery, we're going to have an amazing gallery exhibition focusing on climate justice and especially focusing on marine debris and sort of the story of microplastics and marine plastic debris and how that kind of tells the story of not just what's going on in the ocean, but what's going on sort of in the social justice realm as well. Where do they come from? How do they affect us? How do they affect the people that are have to deal with them? It's really interesting the way that different artists have addressed this issue. Our gallery director, Natalie Ferrier, is you know, spearheading that gallery exhibition and bringing some incredible artists from, you know, across both the country and regionally into the gallery. And then we're going to also be having art installations outside, interactive art installations and artists leading workshops all throughout these 3 days.
And we also are partnering with the Cultural Center of Cape Cod. They have a Hyannis location called the Art Barn, and they're going to be giving a workshop, several workshops on the 10th and 11th, where people can come and work with plastic marine debris and create art too.
And Tim, of course, you're doing the film festival. Uh-huh. Tell us more about the screenings and what went into the film selections.
Sure. Well, first of all, I worked with our pal Judy Laster, the director of Woods Hole Film Festival, and she's been a tremendous help. And it's actually sort of the subtitle for the film festival is Fighting the Good Fight Film Fest, because, you know, any kind of justice involves doing the right thing. And actually, we're going to show Do the Right Thing. That's sort of our... That's our Thursday night screening, and we're hoping, you know, even if somebody's seen it before, it's an opportunity to see it on the big screen. To me, it's possibly the most important movie I've ever seen. You know, the way it treats racial relations in a way that makes us uncomfortable, which it should, until we figure this out. But I just think it's one of the greatest films ever made, and I have so much respect for Spike Lee for making it and for fighting the good fight, really, I think, with all of his films. But anyway, so, you know, the idea is trying to show very different ways of kind of doing the right thing, of fighting the good fight. So... One movie is Viva Verde, which is about Giuseppe Verdi, the composer. Before he died, he realized, okay, I've been very successful. I'm able to retire comfortably. I don't know if he ever retired, but he was comfortable. And you know, but a lot of people that have poured their hearts into the arts, into opera, they haven't been as comfortable as I have in retirement. So what he did was he built this palatial home for retired opera singers and musicians. And this was in the, at the turn of the century, like, you know, around 1900 or so. Well, it still exists, and there are still... And so this movie takes you inside this home where you meet these elderly people. And they're amazing. They're still performing and sharing their music and teaching young people. And so it's like, and Verdi said, somebody asked him, what's your greatest accomplishment? And he said, this home.
Yeah. You know, like, which, a fun place, actually.
I know. It's very cool. It's very moving. Yeah. So there's that. There's Comparsa, which is a movie about two sisters who live in a barrio near Guatemala City. And there was this horrible event where in a an orphanage, although it was also for like young women, teen pregnant young women and other people who have been sort of abandoned, and it was a home for them. But the staff, there were rapes and horrible things going on. So they protested. They ended up being caught. Because they escaped, they were caught, put in a room, a fire broke out, and the guards held the door shut so that, and they all, most of them died, burned it.
Wow.
So here's this horrible thing, but these two sisters create this arts festival to celebrate women, to shine a spotlight on how horrible things were in Guatemala in terms of how women, you know, so many murders and rapes of women in Guatemala. And it's a beautiful, it's an uplifting. Mm-hmm. Even though so it's movies like that. There's a movie about Dukakis by my friend Aaron Trahan, so one of the co-directors, and it's called Dukakis Recipe for Democracy. And while he's making soup, he's talking about activism and being involved in politics and trying to get things done. And, you know, regardless of your politics, it's that's inspiring too.
Yeah.
So it's trying to find different ways of shining light on
what about the Young Filmmaker Showcase?
Okay, that we wanted to make sure that you know, a lot of students will be coming to this festival, but we hope everyone from the community, all ages, like I think the Academy of Lifelong Learning should definitely go see Viva Verde in Dukakis. I think they'll love it. It's not a student showcase for the movie part. It's a young filmmakers showcase. Filmmakers from the Cape, some that have graduated from Four Seas, that are making films, short films, about people fighting the good fight. Mm-hmm. And you know, we wanted to inspire other students. Say, see, you know, we're not in a situation where you have to have some big studio backing. Just get out and do your art, and you can make a difference.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So later today is a sound bath, deep listening, and mark making workshop. Who wants to tell us about
that? Powerful message. It's truly inspiring to encourage students.
I can talk about that.
Okay, go ahead.
That's going to be led by Boston-based artist Nancy Aleo, who is an incredible multidisciplinary artist. She's bringing a lot of sound making instruments, gongs, and other types of sort of percussion instruments. And I've experienced this already. It's a really incredible event to partake in. So she'll create these sounds, and they're all very vibrational, right? So you really have to experience it in person. And you know, you sit there and she'll, you know, hit the gong and you sort of feel the vibrations and you hear the sounds, and then you make marks, just paper and pencil or, you know, whatever, very simple materials, but it's this sort of responsive activity where you just let yourself kind of instinctually respond to the sounds that you're experiencing. If that sounds a little out there, that's okay, because she's really good at kind of making it a very approachable experience. She'll show examples of students that she's worked with before, and how they've taken those marks and applied them to anything from, you know, mathematics, to creating patterns in textiles, to turning them into animations, to just creating, you know, beautiful sort of like drawings out of them. So all these different ways of using mark making just from that intuitive space. But one of the reasons that we thought it was really important to include an activity like that, like this, in a social justice arts festival, is that idea of deep listening and paying attention being a really important and kind of radical action in our times. Mm-hmm. We don't do enough of that anymore. It's you know, we're living in times where our attention is, you know, the economy of attention, right? It's constantly being stolen from us. And, you know, we live in this social media world of doom scrolling and all of that. And we really want this festival to be future focused and looking towards solutions oriented and all of that. So, you know, part of that is just sort of self wellness and kind of coming together and, you know, quieting all of that noise and really thinking about like what is happening right now and being really present.
Marie, this seems like a lot of cool stuff happening. What are you most excited about?
On Friday evening at 7 p.m. at the Tilden Arts Center, we're going to have Kotoko Brass. It is a band comprised of two brothers who actually grew up in Yarmouth and went to DY High School, played in the Cape Symphony Jazz Band, etc., and went off to college, one to Dartmouth, the other to Berkeley, and they formed a band with guys from all over the world. Mm. There's someone from Antigua, someone from Japan, etc. They traveled as a band to Guyana, and they learned, they kind of delved into the music, of Guyanese music, and the central part of the band is the horn section. So they have this dynamic horn section. But it's a wonderful band that I think it's so timely, and we all need something to feel really good right now. So on Friday evening, we're going to take it up a notch and all be able to be interactive with that band. You know, you can dance, or they have an interactive part where we sing with them and move. And I'm just really excited about
that. Sounds like a lot of fun. And all of the events are free except for the band, right? So
But we do want everyone there. Tilden Arts Center is really huge, and we want to make sure that the community knows that they're welcome. So we have a code, and it's WAVES. If you go on our website and register for the music event, feel free to pay if you'd like. We have a very low price point, $5 for students, $10 for faculty and staff, and $15 for the general public. But if you cannot afford it, put the code WAVES in and you get 4 free tickets.
All right. The Waves of Change Arts Festival runs through tomorrow, and events are at the Cape Cod Community College campus in West Barnstable and the Cultural Center of Cape Cod Art Barn in Hyannis. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Tim Miller, Festival Co-Director and Head of the Film Festival Component, Ava Fedorov, Festival Co-Director and Head of the Visual Arts Component, and Marie Blackburn Younger, Festival Community Liaison. Thank you all for being with us and for doing it. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for having us, Mindy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We're going to hear a clip from the Kotoko Brass performing tomorrow evening at the Tilden Arts Center as part of the Making Waves Art Festival. But stay with us after the music for a conversation about fact, fiction, love, and art. We talk with Diana Wald about her book set in 1980s Provincetown. You're listening to The Point. Diane Wald is the author of The Bay Rose Files. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So this is a story of an ambitious young journalist named Violet Mars, and she secures a coveted residency at a prestigious artist and writer's colony in 1980s Provincetown. And she's there under what we might call false pretenses, looking to write an expose. So where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, it's been germinating for years and years and years. I was a fellow for 2 years at the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center as a poet in the 70s. So unlike Violet, it was a different time frame and a different kind of writing. But I always wanted to write about Provincetown, which I've loved since I was a little girl. And I couldn't quite get the story right until I had the character of Violet Maris. And once I had her and I realized that she had done something terrible, I thought, well, what was the most terrible thing that a writer could do would be to steal somebody else's work and, you know, become a fake fellow at this artist colony. So that's where the idea started.
Right. And of course, the home, is, as it's called in your story, is sounds a lot like the Fine Arts Work Center, right?
Yeah, it's veiled, but that's what it is.
And so are the characters in the story purely fiction or are they based on real people?
Yes, they are purely fiction. I didn't want to base it on anyone I'd known there. So I've known a lot of artists and writers in during my whole life. So I just kind of took the most interesting characteristics of a lot of them from other places and made these characters who suited the storyline.
Yeah. And why the 1980s? Why did you set it in the 1980s?
Well, very much because of AIDS. When I was there in the 70s, AIDS wasn't a big topic at all. But in the 80s, I would go back once in a while and realize how difficult this whole situation was for so many people who weren't getting enough help. And I happened to know a couple of people in Boston where I was living then who had HIV or who had AIDS. And the whole thing just, I just wanted to put it back out in the public eye, especially nowadays.
Yeah. And talk about that relationship between Violet and her dear old friend, Spencer. This is such a sweet friendship. And again, I think for those who weren't around when, you know, AIDS now, you know, it was a death sentence in the 1980s, basically. So talk about that relationship between Violet and Spencer.
Yeah. Well, she met him when she was in college. She was a lot younger than he was. She wasn't gay and he was. And there were a million things that should have separated them to the casual observer, but they were the dearest of friends. They had something in common that became larger and larger as the book goes on until, you know, I don't want to tell you what happens, but he's very, very important to the story because what happens with Spencer catapults her into breaking her secret life open.
Yeah. I want you to read a little bit about Spencer. I have to say, when I'm reading about Spencer, I was like, I want to be Spencer's friend. I mean, you know, she's so comfortable with him and you feel that comfort in the story. So I wonder if you'd read a little bit about Spencer.
Yes, I will. Thank you. I'll read this. This is at the beginning of the book. She's already hatched her plot to do an expose, but she doesn't know how she's going to pull it off. So here she is with Spencer. This chapter is called The Beginning of the End. I discussed this goal over dinner with my dear friend and mentor, Spencer Bayrose. If anyone could help me figure it out, it was Spencer. I'd only known him about 10 years, but it seemed like forever. He'd been my college journalism professor, and then a few years later, left academia because what he called circumstantial encumbrances, and miraculously turned up in Boston just as I was looking for a job. He'd landed an editorial position at a big publishing house and was able to convince them to hire me as a junior copy editor. I didn't last very long because I really only wanted to write my own stuff. But my friendship with Spencer was rekindled and thereafter never waned. He was 18 years my senior. He was gay. He was old school and never mentioned it, so I didn't either. He was tall and elegant with wavy gray-brown hair, a finely chiseled nose, and lovely soft blue eyes. His normal speaking voice would put Anthony Hopkins to shame. Sometimes he actually wore an ascot. Even though, as a moderately intelligent and attractive female, I'd had my share of interesting boyfriends, I always felt a little cheated that Spence and I could never be a couple because we got along so well. Spencer still worked at the publishing house where he was beloved among his colleagues. He was better read than anyone I'd ever met and could dash off 10 exquisite paragraphs at the drop of a hat. He'd hate that I used a cliche like that. Spencer and I had a standing dinner date once a month at a little restaurant in Chinatown called Red Lotus, where all the meals featured a kind of fake meat made out of bean curd or something wheaty. It was delicious. There was soft, tinkly music on the loudspeakers, and the tablecloths were always starched and impossibly white. The dining room was on the second floor, overlooking one of the big streets, and at night you could drink delicious umbrella-festooned cocktails and watch the Chinese world go by. The night I told Spencer about my hope to write a piece about the home, I remember we were wolfing down egg rolls at an astonishing rate. He had a napkin tucked in the collar of his shirt. I know, he said. I'm sorry this looks so tacky. I just have to protect my favorite tie. It's so old, I'm afraid it will expire before I do if it has to be dry cleaned one more time.
I think my favorite line in there is when he speaks, he would put Anthony Hopkins to shame. This guy sounds perfect, right?
Very cool.
So how much of your own Provincetown experience did you put into this story?
Only the descriptions of the landscape and the town and the home, because as I told you, the characters were from other places. The Spencer character was from another, is built on someone else I knew at another time in my life. And so I felt Provincetown was a character all by itself, you know, right. The setting became the character, and I wanted to do it justice.
Right. You know, sometimes writers talk about, you know, when they're putting their story together and they have sort of a minor character who just won't stop talking and takes over, right? And they end up with this bigger role than you were planning on. Did that happen in this case?
With Spencer?
With any of them.
Oh, with any of them. Well, you know, that's an interesting question. That might have happened with Frank with a PH.
Right.
Because, There's a little part where she goes on a pseudo date with Frank, and I always wondered about that chapter. But he's a colorful guy, and so I left him in there.
Yeah. All right. So most of your books are poetry. So talk about the difference in the two writing processes for you, because they're very different.
Yeah, they are different and not so different. But I didn't know that until I started writing fiction, only about 5 years ago. Well, that's not true. I started publishing it about 5 years ago. I started writing it when I was in my 30s or 40s, and I was just terrified of it, the whole thing. It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, I had an MFA, so I'd gone to a lot of fiction classes as well as poetry classes, but it just didn't seem to give me any confidence at all. So I put some of that stuff away and dragged it out after I retired 5 years ago.
And why a novella? It's a very quick read. So, you know, for folks who don't want a big book, and it's very engaging. I couldn't put it down. So, but why a novella?
Because I'm very conscious of wanting to stop when the story's over. And you know, a lot of people said to me after they read it, they said, "Oh, I like this a lot, but I want to know what happens at the end." And you know, I'm not going to write a sequel, and I'm not going to tell what I think happened, but I think I tried to drop enough clues along the way so that people could write their own ending in their heads.
And that was kind of my next question. Is it, what is it that you hope readers walk away with after they read the story?
A couple of things. I think one of the main characteristics of Violet is that she's a moral late bloomer. You know, she was 26 when the story starts, and she should have known better at that point in life that what she was doing was going to be hurtful to a lot of people, including herself. And the other thing I think is kind of, it's embodied in the epigraph I chose for the book by Leonard Cohen. He says, "Don't call yourself a secret unless you mean to keep it." Mm. So, you know, Violet couldn't keep it. And that's what happened to her.
Right. So what are you working on now? Are you working on more poetry or more fiction? Or both?
A little more poetry and short stories. I kind of got the short story bug a couple of years ago, and so I've been working on those.
Yeah. And I know people always want to know about a writing process. Do you write every day? What is your process?
I had a full-time job for most of my life, so it was very sporadic. But now Now it's great. I mean, now I force myself, even if I'm not writing something specific, to sit down at my desk and close the door and stay at the computer or the pad for an hour or so at least. So I'm more disciplined in my old age than I used to be.
The book is The Bay Rose Files. Diane Wald, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to put a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.